Hey, Chutzpod listeners. I want to tell you quickly about another podcast that I think you might really like. It's called Love Letters. The show is hosted by Boston Globe advice columnist Meredith Goldstein, and it tells real people stories about dating, relationships, and falling in love. The theme of the new Love Letters season is thanks for the help. You'll hear beautiful stories about the many different ways that people get help or assistance in their romantic lives, from friends, relatives, from therapists, and even from their exes. Love Letters from the Boston Globe and PRX. New episodes are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Joshua.
Hey, Rabbi.
How are things at your house?
Things are okay, although slightly fraught because one of our four, yes, four cats slipped out a window. And although she's keeping close to the perimeter of the house, we are having a very difficult time getting her back inside the house. And so far, in an attempt to save her and retrieve her, rescue and retrieve, I've trapped an opossum and I've trapped a neighbor's cat. Both of which I released back into the wild. But what I'm really trying to do is catch my own cat.
Did you sheepishly bring your neighbor's cat back to their house?
No. Hopefully my neighbor is not a listener because I said nothing. I opened.
You jumped it in the middle of the freeway.
I walked out. I saw this adorable cat. I was like, good news is family. I caught a cat. Bad news, it's not ours. Once I opened the trap, she shot across the street. And I was like, oh, I guess that's her house. But hey, in fairness, she was trespassing.
And also, it was probably great for the other family because that other cat is now not going to be such an about. The cat's like, oh, I thought it would be better across the street at the Molina house, but now.
Yeah, no, the grass is not greener over there. So that's probably learned a lesson or two. And how are you, Rabbi?
I am great. I was in Italy for the first time last week with my husband the week after Passover, and it was delicious. It was really fun.
And was it like, as soon as Passover's over, let's go to the world capital of Chametz?
That's right. That's exactly why this board set their meeting for this specific week. It was like all pasta and pizza all the time, with gelato interspersed as the sort of palate cleansers.
That was going to be my next question. The one time I've been to Italy 25 years ago, but gelato twice daily, like medicine, an early day dose and a late evening dose.
I know, but Josh, you're an Ashkenazi Jew. Are you not lactose intolerant?
I mean, there was nothing I did that was with comfort in mind. I overate. I ate things that don't agree with me. It was a self-punishing but delightful honeymoon.
You and Melly had just gotten married, so you were like, no matter what happens with my stomach.
And now I can look like anything, and also it's okay for you to see how I really eat when I'm not trying to impress anyone.
That's great. Well, look, you guys survived. The marriage survived.
But you enjoyed your trip.
I loved it. I went to the Vatican and I watched a bat mitzvah of a dear friend's child at the Vatican. So I kind of feel like even though it was over Zoom, I feel like that was probably the first bat mitzvah in the Vatican.
Oh, that's funny. I wasn't sure what you meant at first. I was like, wow, they're really, that's some outreach program they've got.
It was a real interfaith family. So the Jewish side had the bat mitzvah, the Catholic side had it, and a papal audience. But the Vatican is really Ungapachke.
Ungapachke. Overly elaborate, excessively decorated, slapped together senselessly, overdone, tacky, ostentatious. Which, all of that fits in that one big long word.
I hope that's not offensive to our Catholic listeners, but it's like, it's the real deal. So, listen, this week's Torah portion, before I begin, what's important to know is that different people are reading different Torah portions. Super inside Jewish baseball as to why this is happening right now. But suffice to say that depending on what denomination you're a part of or whether you live in Israel or the diaspora, you might be reading a different Torah portion than other people between now and the holiday of Shavuot that's coming up.
Interesting.
But the Torah portion that I am studying for this weekend is called Kedoshim.
Kedoshim. Holiness. Holy.
Yes. It's part of the Holiness Code, and it actually has one line in it that is quite famous. I wouldn't say even just for Jews or even just for people of faith. The line is, love your neighbor as yourself.
Ahev et re'echa kamocha.
Ve'ahavta.
Ve'ahavta et re'echa kamocha.
Ve'ahavta le re'echa.
Kamocha.
Yes.
Will the judges accept it? Okay, well, I tried.
Right. And so it's a very, very famous line. And I think it actually is really pertinent in terms of the conversation that we're going to have on the podcast today.
That is true. That's a very good point. I also will say, I take it as a point of pride, probably to an obnoxious extent. When I was younger, when people would say, you know, the golden rule and this and that, I'd be like, we gave it to the world. That's a Jewish thing. I mean, it's universal at this point, but I think we have a claim to make as getting there first.
There have been a number of times where practicing Christians have talked about, like, you know, the Christian teaching of love your neighbor as yourself. And I know that Jesus did say it also, but I want to be like, guys, give us a little bit of credit.
Throw us a crumb.
As I said, I think it's like a, I'm glad that the Torah portion this week, when we're speaking with Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, about a recent trip that he took to Kyiv in Ukraine to meet with Vladimir Zelensky, and sort of the experience of what it means to try to love your neighbor as yourself. And the truth is, the rabbi spent a lot of time talking about this and exactly what the word neighbor means. Is it really someone whose house is adjacent or tent is adjacent to yours? Is it a family member? And, you know, the rabbis really tended to agree that love your neighbor as yourself is about people who are within your sphere, right? So there's someone that you're friends with, someone who is like a companion or a friend or actually a neighbor. It's not like, doesn't mean love every single human being that was ever created. So in a certain way, it doesn't necessarily apply when we're thinking about our responsibility when it comes to what's happening in Ukraine. What does apply is what comes right after it in this week's Torah portion is to take care, to watch out for, to protect the oppressed. And that's really where the rabbis are very clear that ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha is for the people within your sphere. Mm-hmm. Watch out for the oppressed are people both in your sphere, but people far outside of it as well. So that's really the teaching that I'm going to be thinking about as I listen to Jeffrey talk.
Beautiful. Yeah. One question. Is there a rabbinic take on trapping your neighbor's cat for sport? I'm really sad that I led off with that anecdote and then we got into how to treat your neighbor.
Oh, yes. There's a biblical teaching on trapping your neighbor's cat for sport.
Why am I not shocked?
Maybe not for the for sport part, but we are taught that if we see an animal in distress, even if the animal belongs to your enemy, you still have to alleviate the stress on this animal. So I don't know what your relationship is like with your neighbor, but even if you hate your neighbor, you're still supposed to let their cat out of the trap.
Which I did with soothing words and would have gladly pet the cat and fed it and had it not shot across the street in a nanosecond. I would like to think that my behavior was within rabbinic bounds.
All of the emails we're going to get this week are going to be from dog people.
That's possible too. I love dogs too. No offense to Boaz.
No offense to Boaz, the best dog ever. Who knows, maybe one day he'll meet your cats.
Rabbi, we've been talking about having Jeff Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, on the show from the get-go. We've almost been saving him, saying, like, we have to get a little momentum before we bring in this guy that we love, who is so great. But we're finally having him. We finally feel like we're ready for him. And you go way back with him, right? I met him through you. I love him, but I don't know him very, very well, but he delights me. He's just one of the smartest, funniest. He's a one-off. He's the only person I know who's like him.
Oh, that's what a one-off means?
Well, to me, I may have made that up. I think so. He's the they broke the mold kind of guy.
No, that is true. We do go back a dozen years or so. I'm really glad that he decided to come on the podcast. I think he's able to sort of reintroduce us to Vladimir Zelensky in a way that I'm not going to be going over to Kyiv anytime soon, nor should I. It would not be helpful to anyone there. But to have him come back and his reflections on the time they spent together, I found incredibly inspiring. I'm inspired by the conversations they were able to have and by the way that he talks about how Zelensky operates in this world. For those of you who only traffic in earnestness, this is maybe not going to be your interview because there is some laughter, some dark humor that comes during the conversation. None of us are taking Ukraine lightly.
Right. This is what you get with Jeffrey Goldberg, and this is what I love about him.
Well, what I would say is this is what you get when you have Jeffrey Goldberg and Joshua Malina in the same space at the same time.
Oh, maybe I'm partially to blame.
All right, over to the interview. So we want to welcome Jeffrey Goldberg to his first, but God willing, not his last appearance on Chutzpot. I want to begin with what to you might be a silly question, but as a layperson, I've been wondering, how does one actually get a meeting with Vladimir Zelensky? Do you have his phone number?
You figure out who's close to him and you send them emails and you say, can we come over? And then you come over.
And logistically, safety and security wise, how does that happen?
You go to Warsaw and then you take a train and then it goes on for a while and then you get to Ukraine and then you kind of, I'm not supposed to talk about all the various security permutations of getting there because I don't want anybody to get hurt, obviously. But let's just say it's like, you know, in peacetime, it's a flight that takes about an hour, I guess, and it doesn't take an hour anymore, I'll tell you that. But you can't fly for the obvious reasons that the Russians will shoot you down. So you get to Kiev and, you know, you're on Signal and Telegram and everything. And people tell you where to go and you go and then it's nighttime and then it's dark and then you go here and you go there and then people meet you and then you go and then you're there.
How safe did you feel? Sounds rather intimidating and daunting to me.
No, it's fine. I mean, Kiev, when we were there, was not under attack. There were a couple of shellings the day before and then a couple of days later. But this is already when the Russians had pulled back out of the northwestern suburbs, you know, Bucha and Irpin and Hostomel and those places that you all know about because that's where the Russians massacred people. So they were already gone from those places. And Kiev, you know, the Russians thought that they were going to march in, but then obviously couldn't. So, I mean, hotels are open. There are a few restaurants that are open. Some people are on the street. It's not completely abnormal. When we got into the train station, there was a balalaika orchestra playing for the, I guess, some returning refugees, people who had gone out for a couple of weeks and come back. So it had a kind of a normal feel. It wasn't like everybody was hiding in cellars when we were there.
Did you feel from the people that they were grateful that you had come, or was it more like, oh, another journalist?
No, they want attention and they need attention. And so they're happy to see you. And, you know, Zelensky himself is a very personable guy. So we go meet Zelensky, and he is in many ways the anti-Putin. That's what we described him as in our article on theatlantic.com, which you can read if you have access to the internet. He's the anti-Putin. He's not distant and cold. He's actually, I mean, there is something very funny. I've talked about this privately, but not publicly. There is something very, I mean, it's tragicomic. The tragedy is obviously, but the comic part is this is literally a story about a Jewish comedian who somehow wound up becoming president of a country that was about to be swallowed by its superpower neighbor. And he's still a Jewish comedian in a kind of way. He's not particularly, I mean, he's not religious. He's a Soviet era Jew. So he has limited access to that sort of knowledge and those feelings. But you would, Josh, as a Jewish comedian yourself, recognize in him. It's amazing. It's that it's just a mistake of immigration has made him a Ukrainian Jewish president and you an actor in Los Angeles in a kind of way. I mean, if Zelensky's grandparents or great grandparents had made a slightly different decision about where to go, he'd be the head writer on Colbert now or something. It's such a weird family story in a kind of way. I asked him about comedy and humor. I mean, he's obviously a very funny guy. He's made his living being funny. I asked him about jokes in this period. And, you know, he said, look, we're not making jokes and I'm not making jokes. But I know that that's like said for diplomatic reason. I have to imagine that his mind moves in, let's say, Jewish comedic ways. And he's thinking about the ridiculously dark humor of this whole situation. He's just a very accessible. He walks into the conference room. We, you know, it was a long pathways to get to where we were meeting him, but it's a brightly lit conference room. There's, you know, 8 or 10 people in there, his aides and so on. And he walks in and he looks at us and he says, hi, just like that. Hi. That's what I mean by the anti-Putin. One does not expect to walk into a conference room with Vladimir Putin and him to go, hi. And then he comes over, he shakes hands and he sits down and he basically says, oi, my back. It's, you know, stress. It was very funny little routine about his back pain and, you know, some sort of commentary about how when you're born human, you're born with a back. And that means you always have problems because like everybody's back gives them problems. And it was just like this kind of real portrait of a guy who not so long ago was just an entertainer who made his living being accessible and non-threatening in a kind of way. I felt like I recognized him in a way. And like I said, I was just still always struck by the fact that if life had taken a slightly different turn, he'd just be either a stand-up comedian in America or on Saturday Night Live the gifts and the genetic imprint were all there. Just grandparents chose to stay.
You know what's so beautiful about that in a sort of spiritual rabbinic way is that it sort of implies that any of us could actually be Zelensky. I don't know if that's factually true, that literally any of us.
Most people are cowards, so no, I don't necessarily agree with that. You could be in a position where you're Zelensky, but Zelensky obviously is not a coward. Most people are scared about decisions they have to make in life, and he's proven something about himself that I'm not disagreeing with you. I understand your point. I'm just trying to make the point that something happened where this, you know, entertaining Jewish Ukrainian actor and comedian decided that he had to lead his country, figured out a way to lead it. And then when push came to shove, actually is leading it in a way that is a global role model that we haven't seen in some time. So I just don't want to discount that. But I mean, yes, his own family narrative, chances are if our families hadn't decided to come to America 60, 80, 100 years ago, we wouldn't exist because they would have been killed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you happen to be behind the Red Army lines in World War II, as a Jew, you had a fighting chance of survival, not necessarily as a Jew, but your physical body had a chance of surviving World War II. And that's what happened to the Zelensky family, obviously. But this is the same feeling you get in Israel, right? Look at Israelis and realize that that grandfather went that direction and this grandfather went that way. And it is a kind of a mystical oneness that you feel about Lithuanians who grew up in South Africa have a remarkably different life. But back in Lithuania, it was all one ghetto, you know, it was all one thing. Sorry, I don't mean at all like we were all together at Sinai kind of stuff.
No, we like that here. We like that a lot. I was going to say that Zelensky inspires me and gives me hope, not that one day I might be president, but rather that one day I might star in a Netflix comedy.
Yeah, well, you know, the punchline of this is if God willing, Zelensky survives, and obviously the civilized world should be praying every day for his physical and emotional and moral survival, but mainly physical at this point. I wouldn't be surprising if 5 years from now, Spotify announces $100 million. Then Zelensky has to do the actual hard thing, which is come up with podcast ideas. That was the funny part about Obama's post-presidency is like, dude, no one wants to sit around making up podcast ideas. It's really hard. Running America is easy. Making a podcast is hard.
I have a feeling what he's doing in Ukraine is hard also. But, you know, what do I know?
I'm joking. Obviously, it's hard. You know what? The truth is the guy has such a like a North Star. He's the analog. He's the leadership analog to that expression, which I'm going to mangle, that the hungry man only has one thing he has to do all day. Your life is very simple and directed when there's some overarching survival need. It's like, get food. You don't have to worry about status and position and anxiety and this. It's like, find food is the job. And for Zelensky, the job is keep his country alive. And so he has purpose and direction. And I'm not saying that it's not a misery, but he's been handed a strange gift by the universe, which is, I know why I'm here. I know what I'm doing. I'm willing to die for this people and this cause. So he has the peace that comes from clarity.
And did he give you a sense of what that entails daily, his communications, how he goes about, given the situation, doing what he must?
He's a gifted communicator, and he's still enough in touch with what ordinary people are feeling. One of the worries about him, I mean, this is not a worry based on anything people have seen in him yet, but it's hard to be Mandela. It's hard to be a global icon. And there's this question of like, does it change a person over time? He uses very emotionally resonant language. If you look at the way he speaks, it is in a kind of frank, honest, and emotionally open way that obviously vibrates with his own people, and it vibrates around the world in a really useful way. And it's not the way people are used to hearing leaders sound. I'm not saying he's having a good time. I'm saying he's one of those people you could point to in the world that he knows what he's doing. He doesn't have a particularly theological bent to, you know, his understanding of the world or his own role in the world, but he knows what he's here for. And that's, thank goodness for Ukraine that they found somebody who was like that.
Is that his primary function? In other words, the military goings on and responses are handled by others?
Yeah, he's not a military expert. They have generals for that and a defense minister. His role is to, you know, be the tribune of the people, to be the lobbyist for the people, to be the explainer of the people, you know, to agitate for more arms, more aid, more support. And like I said, Ukraine's extreme luck that they got a guy who can communicate well. in that role and who is an appealing personality. I mean, they have three things. They have, you know, the t-shirt and the look, which has been useful. They have highly skilled communications expert, knows how to reach audiences. And the third thing they have, and this is, you cannot underplay this, is that he's Jewish. So when Putin says that it's a Nazi country, the president is Jewish. What are you talking about? The fact that he's Jewish cannot be underplayed as an important strategic value.
And is that why he's spending so much time talking to the Jews?
I think anybody in that position would, I mean, look, people who are under threat of genocide, we don't have to have the conversation about whether this is technically genocide or proto-genocide or something, but people who are under threat traditionally know to go to organized Jewry to talk. Kurds do that. Uyghurs, Rwandans, obviously the Muslims in Bosnia know that the Jewish community is very keenly interested in arguing against genocide. And, you know, there's also, obviously, there's, you know, stereotypes that play into this, which is that if we could just get to the Jews, they'll explain our position because the Jews have so much power. You know, people will always find out the limits of quote unquote Jewish power in these circumstances. But I think with Israel, it's something really complicated because he holds up, he says to the Ukrainians, we're going to have to be more like Israel. We're always going to be under existential threat. Our children are always going to have to carry guns in our defense. Deal with it. That's the first part of Israel. I think the second part is a little bit of tribal disappointment. I mean, I understand the Israeli government's complications on these questions. They're a government like any government, and they have to worry about Russia on their border in Syria. I mean, but I think for Zelensky, it's a little bit personal. Like, guys, you're the Jewish country. There's exactly two Jewish presidents in the world. I'm one of them, and you got the other. You could look out for us. I mean, what Zelensky doesn't understand is the hugely complicated relationship world Jewry has with the idea of Ukraine, Ukrainians. The crazy thing is, like, all the Jews in support of Ukraine is not something historically. I mean, the world is just too strange for script writing sometimes. But how is it that we're aligned with Ukraine, which had, you know, a large history of complicity with anti-Semitism, even with the Nazis? And we're so adamantly opposed to Russia, which liberated Auschwitz and Berlin. I mean, it's just interesting. There are obvious reasons. Ukraine is right and Russia's wrong here. The world moves on, but it's just some of the stuff is so crazy to think about.
Right. And we do have, I mean, at least in America, from what I've seen, some serious Jewish unity around Ukraine. And you don't see that among the Jews.
The only issue that you can get 75% of Americans agree on is that Ukraine is right and Russia's wrong and we should do something. To hell. America doesn't have anything, any other issue right now like that.
Did you discuss Zelensky's Judaism explicitly with him?
He doesn't have Judaism in the way that we think of having Judaism. I mean, it's just, it is him, but he doesn't. Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, it's funny because we talked about, we were there a few days before Passover and Easter. I mean, he's very fluent in it. Like, obviously, we're making jokes about a pharaoh on his border. Ukraine is not going to wander in the desert for 40 years and all the rest. I mean, he's very fluent in it. I just think, you know, he has a very Sovietized understanding of religion, right? And Judaism as a religion is not his cup of tea, but I think ethnically, you know, and I'm no expert on this. I don't know what the non-observant ethnic manifestation of Judaism looks like among, you know, 40-year-old Ukrainians. And also, look, he's going to have to be careful. It's like if there was an American president who's Jewish, you know, you're not the Jewish president. You're a president who happens to be Jewish. And he has, you know, is a mostly Orthodox country, some Catholic, small Jewish population, small Muslim population. And he's arguing for Ukrainianism as a civic nationalism. And you don't even have to say, look, by the way, I'm Jewish and I'm the figurehead. I'm the leader of the state. Everybody understands it. That's what I mean, going back to this point about how important it is symbolically that the president of Ukraine happens to be Jewish at this time.
I think it's interesting that he's been taking on the Russian Orthodox Church so much. I get worried about anti-Semitism.
I mean, it's pretty fraught for a Jewish president of Ukraine to go after the Russian Orthodox Church. This is one of those things, again, we were kind of talking about it. It's like, it's a very brutally honest situation he's in. A large country is trying to kill his country. And so at a certain point, you don't trim what you say. You don't speak diplomatically. You're like, hey, Russian Orthodox Church, you're supposed to be believers in Jesus, but you're killing Orthodox people here. He's already under the guillotine here. One of the appealing things about Zelensky, one of the appealing things about people around him, and sort of one of the appealing things about Ukraine right now is kind of this dark, accessible humor. One of the, obviously, even more attractive about Ukraine right now is their refusal to die, you know, and their pulling tanks with tractors and, you know, Russian warship, go f*** yourself. And it's that kind of insouciant oppositional behavior that is so attractive to people. The David and Goliath story, you can still wind up having these very funny conversations. One of the people in his office I was talking to hadn't gotten back to me in 48 hours on Signal about something. And the staffer was very apologetic. And I said, look, it's okay. Your country was invaded by Russia. And this person said, and I'm not going to do the accent, but it was in a thick kind of, you know, accent, and said, you know, it's a great excuse for anything. Hey, how come you didn't do the dishes? Because Russia invaded my country. Hey, how come you're sleeping with my best friend? Because Russia invaded my country. It's like, it's a perfect. And anyway, the staffer was so funny that I couldn't help myself. And I said, are you Jewish by any chance? And this person said, chef. And I said, which half? And this person said, funny chef. Funny chef. There are these moments of absurdity. By the way, it is like, it's so much better than COVID as an excuse. Russia invaded my country. Oh yeah, I couldn't finish that paper because of COVID. You didn't say that you had COVID. It was just COVID. But this one is like the best one. Russia invaded my country. What do you want me to do?
Right. This feels like such a pure cause to so many of us. Last week's podcast was about Israeli Independence Day and Israeli Memorial Day. And, you know, one of the things that the stories that I was brought up with about sort of the scrappiness of Israel, right, and the tractors and the people being pulled off the boats and being sent out to war. And for a number of reasons, Israel has lost that.
A, the narrative has been changed on it, but it's also a powerful country.
That's exactly right. And so here the Jews sort of get to have this experience again of having the what they call the new Jew, not like the European Jew who got killed in the Holocaust. They have the new Jew, who's Volodymyr Zelensky. And the icing on the cake is that it's also sort of like the scrappy underdog.
Yeah, but you know, it's so funny because this is a very kind of American Jewish discourse because we have the safety of vicariousness. It's like if you asked Israelis, would you rather be weak and vulnerable and loved, or would you rather just be strong and hated? I think they would answer the same way that Tutsis in Rwanda answer that question, and the way Uyghurs would love to answer that question, and the way Tibetans would love to answer that question, which is like, we don't care that much about what you think of us because we know that you love dead Jews and the live Jews are the ones that are problematic. And so I'm sure Zelensky would rather trade 95% of his popularity and his image as a scrappy, sardonic fighter for, you know, 100 F-15s that he could use to bomb the hell out of Russia. And when those bombs hit Russian apartment houses by mistake or on purpose, he'll say, yeah, sorry, just trying to stay alive here. You know what I'm saying? I've learned about the post-Holocaust Jewish response to power and powerlessness by looking at people like Paul Kagame in Rwanda more than talking to Jews. You know what I mean?
Yeah, scrappy underdog stories don't normally end well for the scrappy underdog.
Underdog stories are great, but it's better not to like die.
Scrappy underdog stories, when they're a movie, they end with they lived happily ever after, but that's not how the actual world works. There was a 1968 after 1967.
They don't make the 99 movies where the underdog story ends badly. They make the one movie where it works out okay.
You know, and by the way, I think we all recognize in this conversation that, I mean, this is the Netanyahu problem. You don't have a right to use your past history of extreme victimization to do whatever the hell you want to do. There's no particular reason for certain Israeli behaviors right now. There's no particular reason for certain Rwandan behaviors or, you know, name your oppressed group. And, you know, it's the narcissism of victimhood that you see. And by the way, the narrative in Ukraine and Russia, I'm sure is going to get, you know, more complicated over time. Ukrainians are going to inevitably, these things just happen in war, kill some Russian POWs. They're going to drop bombs on parts of Russia and innocent people are going to get killed. And then it's going to be the stupid narrative flip. You know, it's like instead of just regular, everybody wants a movie. Everybody wants a simple movie, but the stuff is just complicated.
Everyone wants a neat war, and there's no such thing as a neat war. It's just not how it works.
No, and this one has unusual clarity right now. Right now, and we want Ukraine to win. And look, I mean, Ukraine is, they literally didn't do anything to hurt Russia except exist. And that hurt Russia and it hurt Putin psychically. And we understand that. Just as, by the way, Israel's existence hurts some people psycho-emotionally or spiritually or theologically. And therefore, in order to, it has to be erased because there can't be justice in the world while this exists. Putin's attitude toward Ukraine is Iran's attitude toward Israel. it can't exist because the world is out of whack. My understanding of the world and the way it should be organized is out of whack when it exists. So it's very interesting. And like a lot of Ukrainians are identifying with Israel along those lines. I just want to live. I just want to be here and you want to kill me.
Joshua, can you bring us to more of an upper end to this conversation?
He's good. I don't know. I don't think we have to give people a happy ending.
What's the happy ending?
Yeah, there's just an uncomfortable middle. That's where we are.
That should be the name of your podcast.
The Uncomfortable Middle? Or how about The Funny Chef?
The Funny Chef.
Well, Jeffrey Goldberg, thank you so much.
You're the best. Now I see why Shira loves you so much. You're awesome.
Thank you.
One of the roles that Torah plays right now is in giving people a mirror to what they're feeling, what they're experiencing, and maybe even a window yeah. to where they want to go.
I'm Alana Steinhain, Rosh Beit Midrash and Senior Fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute. I'm excited to share that I am the host of Texting, a new podcast where ancient wisdom meets contemporary relevance from Hartman's award-winning digital team. On each show, Hartman scholars Christine Hayes, Yona Hain, or Leora Botnitsky will join me to delve into a Torah text that offers insight and inspiration about the issues that matter to you and to our community.
I got the feeling from the various explanations that the rabbis gave that God also feels broken.
You can listen to Texting at shalomhartman.org/texting or wherever you get your podcasts. I look forward to learning with you.
Thank you, Jeff, again, for an amazing interview. Rabbi, have you watched any of Servant of the People, Zelensky's comedy that is now on Netflix?
I have not, but I think I now want to.
I suggest you do. I mean, it's fascinating. It's just an enjoyable show, and it's clever and well done, and it is funny, and it is interesting. But I mean, magnify that by 10, given his subsequent career. It's just, it's pretty fascinating. And I think you can see in his performance, which, you know, the guy can act, and there's a real tie, I think, into understanding why he's such a good communicator. So check it out, people. Servant of the People on Netflix. And I guess that largely does it for another episode of Chutzpah. Although, if you stick around, the rabbi will give us a little learning about the Omer, today being the 20th day of the Omer. And whom do we need to thank, Rabbi?
I don't know.
Well, certainly we need to thank Tim Shovers.
Always.
He is the fuel that keeps the Chutzpah engine running. He's our executive producer. We want to thank Hadag Nachash for allowing us to use their fabulous tune, Lazuz, as our intro music. We want to thank Jeff Goldberg again for giving us a great interview. We want to thank PRX for distributing us and supporting us. You can learn more about the company at prx.org. And why not? We have a few extra seconds. We want to thank our listeners because they listen. You can follow us on social media of all types. Chutzpah on Twitter, on Instagram, Facebook. Hit us up if you have something to say, good or bad, at chutzpah@gmail.com. If you like the show, give us a nice 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts. If you don't like the show, don't give us a review. It's pretty simple. Also, if you don't like the show, why are you listening? Go home. Goodbye.
No, you should continue to listen if you don't like the show.
Counterpoint. Absolutely. We could use the numbers. If you want to hate listen and tell two friends how horrible it is, it's so horrible it's worth listening to.
As Josh said, on the day that this podcast drops, we will be on day 20 of the counting of the Omer. And the spiritual teaching of this day is called Yesod of Tiferet. Yesod is a word we've heard before. It's about foundation or arguably making something last longer than today. Tiferet is about many ideas, but the one I want to lift up today is the idea of compassion. That when we take the value of loving kindness and the value of judgment and meld them together, what we end up with is compassion, which is trying to see and recognize the other, trying to be of service to the other, even if you can't solve all of the other's problems. And so in the world of Yesod of compassion, we are trying to create a foundation so that we can be compassionate, not just today, but into the future. We're trying to build the muscles of compassion. That's our work for today and for perhaps the rest of this week. How do you build your muscles of compassion? What books can you read about other people's life experiences that perhaps can help you better understand them and therefore have more compassion for them? What tzedakah can you set aside so that you are practicing giving away some of what is yours so that others can live fuller lives? What are the ways that you can walk in the world with eyes wide open, looking forward and out, rather than always turned on yourself inward, so that you can actually see the world around you, understand it better, and build a more healed world? Shabbat shalom. From PRX.